From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Another week, another episode in compromised government secrets. The latest development, a new cache of WikiLeaks leaks, this one naming names. We'll get to that in a minute. But first, we'll address the general question of the government's classification conundrum. The widening river of leaks has left authorities with a puzzle. Once a secret has been revealed, should the government still try to keep it under wraps? Case in point, a memoir by a former FBI agent named Ali Soufan. As a government employee who held a security clearance, Soufan is required to have his book vetted by a variety of government agencies, anyone whose secrets could be spilled in the book. And in fact, Soufan's employer, the FBI, has cleared the book. But the CIA insisted that certain classified information in the book be redacted, even though those former secrets are now widely known. The New York Times' Scott Shane reported on this situation recently. Shane says Soufan has his own explanation for why the CIA wants to redact his book.
Mr. Soufan believes that because his book is quite critical of CIA, that they are trying to interfere with his right to tell the story of both the back and forth between CIA and FBI before 9/11 and the question of whether 9/11 perhaps could have been prevented. And secondly, the story of what the CIA called enhanced interrogation, what others called torture, the program involving waterboarding and so on, which Soufan is highly critical of.
So what does the CIA want to suppress?
For example, a sentence from Mr. Soufan's public Senate testimony, which is easily found on the web, is being excised by the CIA. It's well known that Mr. Soufan was one of the first interrogators of a guy named Abu Zubaydah. However, they've taken the pronouns me, I, my out of Mr. Soufan's chapter on Abu Zubaydah, claiming that the fact that he interrogated Abu Zubaydah, which again has been publicly discussed, remains a secret. According to Mr. Soufan's publisher, virtually all of the dozens of redactions that the CIA demanded, he and his co-author were able to find in public sources.
Is there any evidence for the conclusion that the CIA is trying to protect its image as opposed to just kind of classic bureaucratic stupidity?
You know, it's very hard. The CIA has said that all they are trying to do is protect classified information. But I was able to review some of the redactions that the CIA had imposed or requested. Some of them are a little bit hard to explain as anything other than an attempt to sort of spin the story. For example, there were two hijackers, folks might remember, who were living in San Diego for months before 9/11. There has been a long-running dispute between FBI and CIA over, you know, whose fault it was that those guys were not detected. One of the guys, his name was Almidar, his passport had been copied and sent to the CIA months before the attacks. That fact was in the 9/11 Commission report. That fact was even in the memoir by George Tenet, the former CIA director. But that fact has been removed from Mr. Soufan's book. He says because it makes the CIA look bad.
It is kind of an interesting question. If a secret becomes public, is there any point in classifying it as a secret?
One thing that's happened recently with the massive disclosures of confidential and classified documents by the WikiLeaks organization, there is now a fairly large category of information that you might describe as public but classified. And this has led to all kinds of logical problems where government employees, for example, have been instructed not to read classified diplomatic cables because, technically speaking, they remain classified. People outside the government, of course, can go to the WikiLeaks site or the New York Times site or any other site and read these classified cables all they want. Another case in which this came up was when WikiLeaks released a bunch of documents that were assessments of the detainees at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And the lawyers representing those detainees were told by the Justice Department that they had to continue to treat those documents as classified. they were not allowed to read them on their home computers. They had to go to a special facility to read those documents, even though, again, the documents were on the New York Times site and all over the place.
Soufan isn't the first author, nor will he be the last, who's undergone this redaction process. Give me some other examples. Tell me about Anthony Schaefer.
Anthony Schaefer was a military officer who served as an intelligence officer in Afghanistan for about 18 months, and he came home and wrote a book about it. At the time he wrote the book and published the book, he was working for the Army. Under the rules, he submitted his book to the Army. The Army went through it. I think they, you know, removed some things, negotiated some things, and said, you're good to go. So the publisher went ahead, sent out advance copies of the book. Meanwhile, the Defense Intelligence Agency, who was Mr. Schaefer's employer when he was in Afghanistan, they got a hold of the manuscript and basically flipped out, said there's all kinds of secret stuff in here. This went up the chain of command in the Pentagon, since it was essentially a dispute between the DIA and the Army. And by the time they decided, yes, these were secrets they could not allow to get out to the public, the publisher had already printed the first printing of the book, and the Pentagon had to buy the whole printing for $50,000 of the taxpayers' dollars, which had the ironic effect of making the book a bestseller. Meanwhile, the advance copies that go out to reviewers and that kind of thing had already been sent out. Those did not have any redactions. Those unredacted copies of this memoir began showing up on eBay. I saw one for $2,200. So people were cashing in, and the secrets were getting out anyway.
Now, I want to be fair to the intelligence community. Its employees are obliged to sign an agreement that says that should they ever write about their experiences in the employ of the government, the work is subject to review and redaction and so forth. So on the face of it, there's no reason for us to have the jitters about excessive government interference. I mean, everybody knew this all going in, right?
Well, that's exactly right. That's what the agencies say. That's certainly what the CIA says. But I think the difficulty comes in the fact that what is or is not classified turns out to be an extremely subjective thing.
We were talking about the paradox of public classified information. Is the government making any attempt to square the circle between its bureaucratic regulations and the reality of the digital world?
It poses a huge dilemma for the government, because if the government were to change the rules and say anything that is made public anywhere is no longer classified, that's almost like an invitation for disgruntled employees of the intelligence agencies to download masses of secrets and give them to WikiLeaks or give them someone else or just put them up on the web themselves, which would, you know, wave a magic wand and say, okay, now it's all unclassified. So the government doesn't want to create that incentive. So I think the only thing the government can do is, on the one hand, tighten up its own security. But everyone in the government admits that far too much information is classified in the first place. And so they may have to begin to distinguish better between what really needs to be protected and what government activities can be described in public without doing anybody any harm.
All right, Scott. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Scott Shane is a national security reporter for the New York Times. This week, WikiLeaks released some 150,000 documents from its trove of 250,000 U.S. diplomatic cables, the same trove that made headlines when WikiLeaks partnered with major newspapers for an initial release last fall. This time, WikiLeaks is bypassing the mainstream media, opting for crowdsourcing instead by asking its supporters to sift through the documents for good stories. This release has not made many headlines. In fact, most of the coverage slams WikiLeaks on two counts. First, because the latest release includes names of diplomatic sources, which puts those individuals at risk. And second, because a file containing all 250,000 of those cables is now available online, also unredacted. For its part, WikiLeaks contends that the file was encrypted with a password and that a Guardian writer is to blame for revealing that password to the world. Adam Clark Estes, a writer for the Atlantic Wire, explains how the password first emerged.
They published it in a book, actually, by The Guardian's investigations editor, David Lee. David Lee wrote a book about WikiLeaks and wrote about having gotten this password that gave access to all of the cables. Of course, that book came out in February. David Lee said at the time that WikiLeaks let him know the password, but also said they were going to change it.
He published it in his book in February with the understanding, he says, that by the time he published it, he didn't think it was going to be the password to anything. But is it now the password to all of this stuff that is sitting out there in public on the web?
It's interesting because WikiLeaks at first seemed to deny that it existed. They sort of pushed back on reports that they had let the document out there. But since then, they've turned back on that. And with The Guardian revelation, they've now confirmed that it does exist and that it is potentially dangerous.
Potentially dangerous because the names that had been redacted in the first batch presumably are not redacted in this source file, right? So the sources who were protected the first time around and now may be very vulnerable.
It also highlights one of the problems that a lot of people had with WikiLeaks being called a journalistic organization. They were able to skirt around that by working closely with The New York Times and with The Guardian and with Der Spiegel because everything would essentially go through the newspaper's filter. A year ago, we had a really well-focused and powerful partnership between WikiLeaks and the newspapers. Their new approach, trying to crowdsource it, inevitably seems kind of amateurish.
When you're trying to decide whether WikiLeaks are heroes of transparency and democracy or just reckless vandals, is it possible that the answer to that question is both?
I've been trying to figure this out, too. I've been trying to figure out, for instance, why they're lashing out at The Guardian, why they're turning on the newspapers that used to be their friends, and what exactly their intentions are. And so far, all signs kind of point to them being well-intentioned in them also being incredibly disorganized. And despite their intentions to do good, the fact that they are disorganized and inconsistent and behaving erratically is inevitably dangerous.
All right. Adam, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Adam Clark Estes writes for The Atlantic Wire.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. No sooner had Hurricane Irene blown through the eastern seaboard than the backlash began. Hype, they cried. Irene was a bad storm, but was it bad enough to justify all that coverage? Did we really need Geraldo Rivera's report on the hurricane preparedness of his own family?
Our mom, 90, almost 92-year-old mom, is now at Craig's house. He's a bit inland. She was with me. We evacuated her from...
Howard Kurtz of the Daily Beast described the coverage as, quote, a tsunami of hype. Though, to be fair, he did note that it wasn't hype for the families who lost loved ones and the reporters who did good work. But even TV news, blamed for most of the hurricane hype, got in on the anti-hype surge.
Was it worth all of the hype and wall-to-wall coverage 24-7 on the mainstream?
The New York Times' statistically driven blogger Nate Silver applied math to the question and found hype in the charges of hype.
I was surprised to read columns by, for example, Howard Kurtz in the Daily Beast, who's a media critic there, who said, you know, oh, this thing was overblown. It wasn't really a big deal. I mean, that didn't seem to square with the facts that it had caused a lot of damage and destruction. And I think the combination of Howard Kurtz's column being a little bit sanctimonious on the one hand, and also on the other hand being just not really correct on the facts, or if you try and objectively say how bad was this hurricane, how much damage did it cause, it ranked pretty high up the list.
So in trying to determine whether or not the early coverage of Irene was proportional with regard to whether there was hype, you actually broke down the coverage into something called news units. And can you describe what those are?
So if 10% of the articles on a given day published in all newspapers in the United States mention a storm, that counts as a news unit. So some storms, for example, had as many as 3 or 4 news units worth of coverage while they were still active, meaning that they basically dominated the news cycle for several days. And with Irene, the score was about 2.5. Basically, it equates to 2.5 days of kind of saturation coverage, which is a lot.
Yeah, you said that Irene ranked 10th in news coverage from among the 92 named tropical storms that made landfall in the United States since 1980. Well, 10 out of 92 seems high. Do you think it deserved to rank at number 10?
Well, how destructive was the storm? If you measure it by economic damage, they're concentrated around a number like $14 billion, which would be quite high. Adjusted for inflation would be, I think, about 8th or 9th on the list of storms since 1980. If you look at the loss of life, that's actually worse, where now you're up to about 45 overall fatalities. That might rank as high as 3rd since 1980.
Irene ranked roughly 3rd in terms of fatalities, roughly 8 in terms of property damage, and it got the 10th most coverage among storms. So, if anything, underhyped?
You know, yeah, if anything, I suppose it was underhyped relative to other hurricanes. But say that it had totally missed, right? Say that it had kind of swum off to the Atlantic Ocean and caused very little damage at all. You still had a storm that was very, very threatening. And we know from Katrina that when you have a storm which bears down on a major city, the risk of a catastrophic impact becomes much higher.
I mean, we're talking about coverage of a story that hasn't happened yet. And meteorology is not perfectly predictive, as we all know. So do you blame a media outlet for giving the best guess in terms of the coverage of serious consequences, even if they don't pan out?
Any weather forecast has uncertainty. It had been a Category 2 instead of a Category 1, you might have had 4 or 5 times as much damage to property. So you'd be talking about a $60 or $70 billion disaster. If it had been a Category 3 storm that followed the same trajectory and was as big and slow as Irene was, then you're talking about probably a disaster in the hundreds of billions. Do you want to talk about an overhyped story, you know, like the D.C.-based earthquake, for example? That's an overhyped story.
If you want hype, look to the earthquake.
They're a lot easier targets, I think, than a destructive hurricane, potentially. I'm not saying it's journalism at its finest, you know, and I think it would behoove news departments around the country to have, you know, journalists who are more versed in meteorology, right? To have a better understanding of that in the press accounts, I think, would be useful as well.
So there may be an expertise gap, but your numbers tell you there wasn't hype.
Every story on cable news is hyped. But I think the coverage was proportionate relative to the amount of damage the storm caused.
Nate, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Nate Silver writes the 538 blog, which you can find at nytimes.com. When a paper released by a scientific journal turns out to be wrong, either due to human error or intentional fraud, the journal's editors often will issue a retraction, advising scientists to disregard the research. A recent Wall Street Journal study has found that the number of such retractions is soaring. In fact, since 2001, the number of retractions issued by journals has increased 15-fold. We asked Wired magazine science writer Jonah Lehrer what he thinks is going on.
The explanation I'm most attracted to is simply that there's been a norm change. In years past, they used to wait for serious evidence of scientific fraud, and often co-authors would have to insist on retraction. Now I think they're much more willing to retract a paper if there's simply an error.
Can you give me a couple of examples so we can understand what's at stake?
The kind of retractions that are most worrisome are retractions that very quickly become the basis for policy. So we're talking here mostly about retractions in clinical trials.
So an example might be a kidney drug.
Could be a kidney drug. It could be things like hormone replacement therapy. The list goes on and on and on. I mean, you know, I think people are now pushing back against antioxidants, against the beneficial effects of various vitamins. So there are lots and lots of clinical trials that have gotten lots of media attention. And then their retraction is published in the fine print. I also want to make the point that I don't think there's anything necessarily bad about an increase in retraction. I think if anything, this represents, you know, a new kind of transparency in peer review.
You weren't that bothered by the retraction study, but there was a related study that really did worry you.
Yes, this was a rather obscure paper published in a rather obscure journal called Ecosphere, which looked at a small subset of papers in the fishery sciences. It was done by researchers at the University of Washington. And they were interested what happens after a paper is refuted or retracted. So let's say a paper is published in Nature or Science, and they just looked at papers published in these two very prestigious journals. And then a few years go by, numerous papers have come out, and they've proved that this paper just isn't true, that these researchers made a mistake. What happens next? Is this falsified paper, is it still cited? Or do other scientists recognize the mistake? And what they discovered is, I think, deeply depressing if you believe in peer review, because they found that the number of citations for the paper which has been soundly refuted don't decrease. And in fact, that they remain years and years after being refuted, but 17 times higher than the refuting papers. Mm-hmm. So it's as if the mistake has been demonstrated, it just still persists. It's very tough to get rid of.
Well, we know that in the mainstream media, once an impression is made, it's very hard to unmake. But you would hold fellow scientists to a higher standard. You would think that they would at least keep up with their own research.
You would certainly hope so. And in fact, I think one of the most troubling parts of this paper is they show that even when these papers which are showing that the original paper is wrong are cited, about 10% of the time, they're cited as demonstrating affirmative proof. So scientists cite them in the wrong way.
So they don't even read their own citations. Is this because of an over-reliance on grad students?
No. I think lots of people use citations without fully reading the papers. They look at the title and maybe the abstract. I think one thing that's happening is that it's tough to let go of a beloved theory. These papers were very influential, often for up to a decade. So the mind, for all sorts of reasons, struggles to let go of those ideas.
So what do we do about this?
One of the very simple fixes is simply when scientists call up a paper that's been refuted in PubMed or Google Scholar or one of these search engines that scientists all over the world use, that they should be automatically linked to the refuting papers. Mm-hmm. So if a study isn't true, we should know that it's not true, and the papers that prove that it's not true should be right there as well. So they're easy to cite, and the record is automatically corrected.
On the other hand, you said that even when scientists are aware of the contradictory papers, they either don't read them or misread them or use them to support the original wrong conclusions.
Well, I think we'd have to invent a new format. It'd be some new kind of link where you'd know that these were citations which weren't supporting the original paper, but were actually contradicting it.
Red font.
Exactly. In the scientific literature, the vast majority of citations, of course, are positive. They're showing that they're building on these earlier discoveries. This would be the opposite kind of citation.
Mm-hmm.
The more ambitious, I think, fixes focus on things like forcing scientists to declare in advance what their hypotheses might be. So, you know, in a lot of scientific fields, one of the problematic things has been that scientists, let's say you're doing some brain scan research, and you're trying to find some significant correlation between people doing X and Y happening in some particular brain area. Because of the standards of scientific publishing, you'll often have to get a result that passes the mystical test of significance, which shows that it's very, very unlikely that these results were a byproduct of randomness. Mm-hmm. So scientists will often keep on searching, keep on replicating experiments until they get that result that passes the test of significance. And so the hope of having this kind of database where scientists have to register their original hypotheses is that it'll make that harder to do, that scientists will have to say in advance what they're looking for. And if they can't find that original relationship, then that'll be part of the paper they eventually publish. The hope is that it would introduce a new kind of transparency to the scientific process.
Jonah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jonah Lehrer is a science writer for Wired. Ivan Oransky is a doctor, the executive director of Reuters Health, and founder, along with Adam Marcus, of Retraction Watch, a blog that scours scientific journals for retractions and investigates the stories behind them. Retraction Watch recently celebrated its first birthday, and so we asked Ivan to pick out some of the year's most noteworthy or outrageous retractions. He began with a story his co-founder broke, that of Joaquin Bolt, an anesthesiologist who had dozens of his papers retracted all at once.
There's a guy named Steve Schaefer. He's actually a Columbia anesthesiologist. If there are heroes in Retraction Watch, Steve Schaefer is one of the heroes. And he has really led the charge to retract up to about 90 of Joaquin Bolt's papers, or maybe even be more. The reason why is that Bolt had not obtained the proper ethical approval to do his studies. There's something called institutional review boards. They look at the protocol and say, this is safe, it is reasonable, it is likely to produce a result. And Bolt had not obtained that approval.
Was he directing these studies to prove a point or just make some money or sell a product? I mean, what was his motivation?
Sometimes it's as simple as glory. If you have grant funding, it is determined by how many times you publish. You get tenure based on how often you publish. Sometimes companies are sponsoring your work, and they will sponsor more of your work if you publish more.
In the case of Bolt, what was the direct impact on patients?
There was direct impact on patients who were having anesthetics delivered to them that they didn't know about, who were in trials that they didn't know about. Even if you sign up for a trial, you are supposed to know what the risks are. If someone hasn't obtained ethical approval, there's no way to know whether they have actually delivered that information to patients. And it's pretty clear he more than likely didn't.
There's this issue of opacity that you guys cover a lot on Retraction Watch. You'll call up somebody who retracted a paper and ask why, and they won't tell you?
That's been our experience far too often. We had a sort of classic post with a cardiac surgeon in Philadelphia who edits a journal that had retracted a paper. And when Adam called him and said, we'd like to know more information about this retraction because the notice really doesn't say very much, what he chose to say instead of, I don't want to tell you, is, it's none of your damn business. We think it is our damn business. Taxpayers more than likely paid for the research. We think it's patients' business.
Let's move on to a journal called Applied Mathematics Letters, which published a paper by a professor named Granville Sewell, who suggested that the theory of evolution actually violates the second law of thermodynamics, which says the quality of energy deteriorates over time in a closed system, or something like that.
More or less.
Entropy.
Exactly. It involves entropy, and I will tell you that no matter how I describe it now, someone will write in and say that we've gotten it wrong. But in the somewhat oversimplified sense, it is that in a closed system, entropy increases. So he's saying that if you have evolution, that it's violating that because you're having sort of more order.
It was roundly condemned.
What happened with that paper was quite remarkable. It was published, and then very quickly, almost the moment it was published, the editor ended up retracting this, but then Sewell sued. That's somewhat unusual. Elsevier, a major publisher who publishes this journal, settled with Sewell for $10,000. They also really lawyered the retraction notice which appeared. What the retraction notice says is it wasn't about the quality. That's not why we retracted this paper. We retracted this because it was inappropriate for our journal. So they really gave the intelligent design community the pitch right down the middle because they could now say, no one's questioning the result. They're just saying it was inappropriate for our journal.
This seems to be extremely worrisome for the scientific community. If you can defeat what you're implying are facts by legal fiat, then we're in big trouble.
I would completely agree. One of the things to note here is that Applied Mathematics Letters was, you know, in law enforcement, they talk about someone who is known to law enforcement. That's a sort of polite way of saying has probably been picked up for something before. So Applied Mathematics Letters was known to Retraction Watch. They had published another bizarre paper that claimed that science and spirituality both came from space. We're still not sure what that means.
We're made of stardust, Ivan.
You know, we're not even sure what he meant by space.
Having covered the medical research business so closely and all of these retractions, what do you think about the state of scientific journals and the way that scientists communicate with each other before all of that stuff gets communicated to the rest of us?
When you look at a paper, there's a kind of finality to it. It's, look, here it is. It's something you can almost frame and put on your wall, or in this case, on your CV. If you were to say, look, here's what we found so far, and let us open up the data for you, let us show it to you, which would have probably prevented some really high-profile cases from going as far as they did. If you treat that as a process and say, this is how science works, nothing is final, we're just getting there.
So papers are artificial endings to a process that doesn't end.
Absolutely. When you actually look at the process of how science works, there aren't that many eureka moments. And when you learn the most is when you've actually made a mistake or tried something that didn't work. And if we start using that narrative and don't have to end it.
Stop gearing yourself towards the eureka moment?
Stop gearing yourself toward the eureka moment. Stop gearing yourself toward the study of the week.
Annals of Thoracic Surgery, Applied Mathematics Letters. It's a world apart from the rest of us. It's hard to understand the stakes for the rest of us.
But some of these have really high stakes. Quite frankly, science almost always starts in some of these lower tier journals. And in fact, a lot of the negative studies, it turns out, in other words, studies showing a lack of effect, are published in those journals. So we still need to pay attention to them.
This is the ground floor of the process of sharing and developing scientific information.
Absolutely. Some of these ideas will make it to the big time.
Ivan, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for having me, Brooke. It was a great conversation.
Ivan Oransky is the founder, along with Adam Marcus, of Retraction Watch, which you can link to at onthemedia.org.
Coming up, we remember folklorist extraordinaire Stetson Kennedy, who used the Superman radio show to fight the Ku Klux Klan.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound.org. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Right now, millions of kids are returning to high school. But for others, that part of their lives is over. No more wake-up yells from mom, no more yellow buses, no more hours spent with other kids they've known forever. Most teenagers look forward to the change. TV writers, on the other hand, don't like change. Every beloved character that departs from form poses a risk. But what happens when your show is set in high school? High schoolers must eventually grow up. Even worse, they have to graduate. Kevin Fallon, a pop culture writer for The Atlantic, has taken a look back at how different shows have handled the graduation gauntlet. But first, we wanted to know, what exactly is the appeal of high school? Hospital dramas give us life and death. What are the stakes in high school?
Life and death? Do you remember being in high school and how much gravity every little moment, you know, had in everything that you did?
It's that knife edge, especially in high school, between innocence and experience.
On all these high school shows, there's sort of this appeal of watching the kids do things where they think they're acting adult-like. And sometimes the kids actually are acting like adults, like on Veronica Mars.
Okay, Veronica Mars is a high school kid, but she's also a detective who works at her father's detective agency and essentially keeps it going, right?
Sure. We have this reality of a young teenager and all the petty things that teenagers go through. But at the same time, she has this very adult second life as an investigator. And it's, you know, the way those two things work together that's so exciting for viewers to watch.
How's school?
If you think we're going to talk about my school day and not the fact that Celeste Kane was in your office 10 minutes ago, you're deluded.
Mm-hmm. You're making good grades?
Kane's got something on the side, doesn't he?
You know what? Say what you want about real cheese. I am a fan of the orange powder packet stuff.
My grades are fine, and I like the orange powder, too, but can we please talk about Mrs. Kane?
Yes. She thinks he's seeing someone. Late nights, motel matches, the usual.
Sexual appetite?
Gone.
Did you take the case?
Well, we need the money, Veronica.
Good.
Of course, the problem is, what happens when she graduates?
Exactly. You know, the show ended when she was still in school, but the showrunners actually made a promo that envisioned what her life would be like as an adult in FBI training school. You lose that fantasy element of the high schooler acting like an adult.
So how do you keep it going when the kids start aging out?
You know, graduation is sort of this looming threat to creators of these teen soap operas. Beverly Hills 90210 quite famously was very ambiguous about the ages of the cast when the show first started. In the very first season, it was assumed that they were juniors because they were getting their driver's license and taking their SATs and preparing for college. And then the next season, they were also getting their driver's license and preparing for SATs and looking at colleges again. So they, in essence, repeated their junior year. Another example is One Tree Hill, which is a CW drama which has been going for a very long time. its first four seasons, it actually had one season represent 6 months in the high schoolers' lives. So it got 4 years out of 2 years of high school.
You point to a number of examples where students pass up their opportunities to stay basically on the program.
You know, there's this sort of legendary way that Beverly Hills 90210 dealt with it, and it's sort of become a running joke in the world of TV where magically everyone ends up in the same city again. Just like on Gossip Girl, suddenly everyone is back in New York, even though they all graduated and had opportunities to go all around the world. And yet they all ended up back in the same circle of gossip, back on the Upper East Side.
Yeah, that sounds pretty
suffocating.
The
graduation episode is such a wonderful opportunity for a TV drama, even for TV comedies. And that's part of why there's such outrage when these characters make decisions in the graduation episodes that just don't ring true. And it's something that another TV show, Boy Meets World, also did. The characters of Cory and Topanga were sort of soulmates. They went through 7 years of middle school and high school together. And then at graduation, writers took the opportunity to create a really dramatic moment where Topanga had to decide either stay with Cory or go to Yale. And that was another gasp moment for viewers.
So you're going to say something. Was it important?
You mean that I decided what I want to do with my life?
Yeah, that.
Mr. Feeney said I should go to Yale unless I have a really good reason not to.
Well, there isn't any good reason.
Actually, there is.
Myra Zinkerman.
Cory.
What?
Ladies and gentlemen, the John Adams High School class of 1998.
Will you marry me?
Will you marry me?
Cue sappy music.
And the audience goes, boo.
Exactly. And then we have this, you know, opposite end of the spectrum where the writers take the graduation moment to bring a character around to a nice, tidy conclusion, like on Friday Night Lights, where the character of Tyra was sort of the high school beauty who couldn't catch a break despite her best intentions. She's struggling to get into college, really trying to turn her life around. And then finally, you sit with her as she writes a college essay, and it sort of just encompasses this entire journey she's been on.
I want to fly somewhere in first class. I want to travel to Europe on a business trip. I want to get invited to the White House. I want an interesting and surprising life. It's not that I think I'm going to get all these things. I just want the possibility of getting them. College represents possibility. The possibility that things are going to change. I can't wait.
Okay, so you've got the problem in high school shows of maintaining an arc after the circuit is completed. So do these shows just have to end, like childhood?
Not necessarily. Part of what happens when these shows become so popular is that there's a mood and a writing style and the sort of universe created that viewers fall in love with. With the case of Friday Night Lights, fans really embraced the new characters they brought on after they had graduated Tyra and some of her classmates off. And the mood of the show was the same. The writing was the same. The truths that they were trying to portray were all the same. And the show stayed on air for 3 more seasons of really acclaimed drama. So it's proof that a show doesn't necessarily have to end when its characters graduate and life goes on after some of those leads are phased out.
Let's talk about life imitating art. Did you have expectations for your own graduation because of what you saw on these shows?
Absolutely. You know, there's the looking back and regret, and there's nostalgia, but there's also the hope and looking forward. When you're sitting there in your cap and gown waiting to graduate, those thoughts actually do go through your mind. And sometimes just watching it on TV sort of gives you permission to say those things out loud during the actual ceremony. And all those things that you see in the graduation episodes of these TV dramas internalize as expectations for your own life.
Kevin, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Kevin Fallon is a pop culture writer for TheAtlantic.com.
What are we going to do? I don't believe.
Stop moaning. You're going to pass this test. You're going to graduate.
Oh, come on, Fonz. It's out of the question. The test is tomorrow morning at 8:30.
Let me tell you something. I think you're forgetting that you got graduation, one of the most important things in your life. You got your big five. You got life, you got death, you got marriage, you got graduation.
Kevin Fonz, that's only 4.
What's number 5?
Hey.
In 1937, Stetson Kennedy dropped out of the University of Florida at the age of 21 to join the Federal Writers Project, part of the Depression-era Works Progress Administration. Kennedy had grown up driving around the Florida countryside collecting debts for his father's furniture store, and as he traveled, he also collected the stories of the people he visited. The Federal Writers Project would pay him to do exactly the same thing, but it provided him with an early portable sound recorder about the size of a coffee table. Kennedy lugged it everywhere, talking to just about anyone who would talk to him. What he did during the Depression set the course for the rest of his long, eventful life. Historian, author, activist, muckraker, and candidate for the U.S. Senate, Kennedy died on Saturday at the age of 94. Peggy Bolger is the director of the American Folklife Division of the Library of Congress. She wrote her Ph.D. dissertation on Kennedy and interviewed him hundreds of times. Peggy, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
What kind of material was he collecting?
Well, of course, for the folklore unit, he collected everything from folk music, folk dance, talked to people who were craftsmen. But he also was doing oral histories with people who, for instance, were working in the turpentine camps of North Florida.
In Cross City, Florida, one of the largest turpentine camps in the state, we organized a recording session around a campfire at night. And after a while, I began asking questions about, why don't you leave and get out of it? And one elderly hand, as they called themselves, he said to us, the only way out is to die out. He said, if you try to leave, they'll kill you. And the minute I started asking questions like that, getting responses like that, some of the young blacks jumped up and ran off into the woods to serve as sentries. And sure enough, a bit later on, they came dashing back up and said, sing something quick. So, here come the man.
The Federal Writers Project created a treasure trove for the likes of you, folklorists, academics, and so forth. In its time, it was widely considered make work and controversial right up to the time the U.S. entered the war and manufacturing jobs essentially displaced a big part of the New Deal. What happened to Stetson Kennedy when the WPA went away?
So Stetson had tried to sign up for the military like everyone else, and he had an old back injury which prevented him from serving. So as he told me, he said, well, I just decided that I would fight fascism at home. And so he infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan in Stone Mountain, Georgia, working with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. He was using his work as a folklorist to document what they were doing. Basically, he demonstrated how they were not a educational, charitable organization, nonprofit organization, but in fact, they were a terrorist organization, that they were conspiring to deny people their civil rights. And so ended up getting their charter revoked as a nonprofit organization in Georgia, and therefore they owed something like $500,000 in back taxes. So they went bankrupt and had to disband for a while.
Undercover folklorist. This sounds like a joke. You know, it sounds like the premise of a Jim Carrey movie or something. To what extent was he a police informant, a journalist, a citizen activist? I mean, what exactly was he when he infiltrated the Klan?
Well, Stetson's always been kind of a maverick. I mean, it wouldn't have mattered if the Georgia Bureau of Investigation had said, no, we don't want you to do that. He was going to do it. He was going to infiltrate the Klan. And he was going to write about it.
Once I got in, it was obvious to me that I couldn't go to the police, because at the very first meeting, I could see the police uniforms, blue pants sticking out beneath the Klan robes, and a great many khaki trousers of the sheriff's deputies. So I went to the FBI, and sure enough, at the next Klan meeting in Grand Dragon, Samuel Green got up and said, had a little call from the FBI last week, said, warning me that we've been infiltrated. Said, you can't ask for better cooperation than that.
Luckily, he was working with some other people who were undercover so that he wasn't just totally alone, because a very dangerous thing to be doing. He was also working with the producers of the Superman radio program. And
I have to interrupt you because I just want to make this clear. His media channel was not the New York Times. It was not the Atlanta Constitution. It was the radio show Superman.
Right. At the time, the radio show Superman was like a soap opera. They would have these thematic series that would be 10 to 12 shows. And so they had one whole series called The Clan of the Fiery Cross. And it was basically Superman battling what was the Ku Klux Klan, but they never used the word Ku Klux Klan.
Drew Pearson was a syndicated investigative reporter, a muckraker, the predecessor to Jack Anderson in the column called Washington Merry-Go-Round. He was really the one who plucked Stetson Kennedy from obscurity to the prominence of being a national figure himself.
Pearson had a weekly radio broadcast coast to coast. So made a deal with Pearson to broadcast minutes of the Klan's last meeting. Every Sunday afternoon we'd broadcast the names of judges and policemen and businessmen, politicians, all sorts of people who had attended the last meeting of the Klan. So the minute we did that, they never showed up again. And recruitment dropped. And best of all, violence came to a stop, all because of infiltration. So it was very effective while it lasted.
At one point, Kennedy ran for the U.S. Senate in Florida, lost. But through no fault of Woody Guthrie, the iconic American folk singer, who wrote his campaign song for him.
He was great friends with Woody Guthrie, who had read Palmetto Country and had written to Stetson and praising him. And Stetson invited him to come live on his land if he wanted to, and Woody took him up on it. And while he was there, he wrote 88 songs. And about five of those songs were campaign songs for Stetson's run for the Senate, including one that's just simply called Stetson Kennedy, which subsequently was recorded by Billy Bragg and Wilco.
Stetson Kennedy, writing his name in. Stetson Kennedy.
You know, when you think of his life's trajectory, he continued to be an activist for many different causes that were the big causes of the 20th century. And today, I wonder who will be that activist for the 21st century.
Peggy, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Peggy Bulger is the director of the American Folklife Division of the Library of Congress. Some of the recordings you heard were produced by Barrett Golding for a 2002 documentary that aired on All Things Considered. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, and Sara Abdurrahman, with more help from Emily Chin and Joe Rosenberg, who are leaving us this week. Guys, thanks very much for your help. And the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rob Granis.
This week, we say goodbye to Nazanin Rafsanjani, referred to variously as Naz, Naz, and occasionally Marzipan. As a person, she's exceptionally kind and patient. As a producer, she's uncanny. She'll come up with an interview idea, say with some woman doing a blog about Yemen that doesn't seem to have all that much to recommend it, and she'll know, somehow she'll just know, that this particular blogger, that particular interview, will strike at our common humanity or mark a passage in our national consciousness or otherwise achieve something real. It seems weirdly hyperbolic, but I'm serious. A Nazanin interview was always marked by exceptional, memorable heart.
Naz has been with us for 5 years, big ones marked by marriage, a baby, the strengthening of her professional voice, and an intention to use it. Here's the end of a piece she did about a kid who staged a funeral for his old name to outrun his youthful online indiscretions.
Back at the funeral, a friend is delivering the eulogy for Peter's name.
May he lead a timid, uneventful life. Marked by no accomplishments that anyone would ever care to document online.
A couple of years ago, Google CEO Eric Schmidt joked that everyone growing up now should change their name when they're 21. But perhaps there will come a point when we'll all have something awkward or even potentially damaging about us on the web. And if it's public for everyone, then maybe we're protected by the crowd. All of us living out our most embarrassing moments, one Google search at a time, in front of one another.
Nas is ready to go public. She's starting a podcast on parenting. It's going to be Marza-fantastic.
We love you, Nas. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.